Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, delivered to your earbuds via the internet. You know, it's a series of tubes. Our program is supported by listeners, and let me single out Michael McMillan, James Balk, Mark Lisgard, and Mark Brodsky. They're all voluntary subscribers to the Peter B. Collins Show. If you're able and inclined, you can support it too. Just go to my website, peterbcollins.com. On the right-hand side of the homepage are the links. You can sign up for a voluntary subscription starting at $5 a month. Today's podcast, loosely, is about tolerance. And we are recording our conversations on the Martin Luther King holiday. In our second segment, investigative journalist Jason Leopold returns. His latest story about religion in the military is quite alarming. There's a new program called the Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Program that's run by one of the people who helped design the Bush-era torture programs. And this is basically forcing some soldiers to embrace a higher power. They don't propose a specific religion. They're very careful to skirt that. But they are promoting spirituality and what I would call religiosity in the military. And Jason has the story for us coming up later in this podcast. But I'm delighted to start off the program today with retired Congresswoman Pat Schroeder. She served in the House for 12 terms, 24 years, and she is retired now. But I had the honor of talking with Congresswoman Schroeder on many occasions in the early 1990s, and it's great to speak with you again, Congresswoman. Thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Well, thank you, Peter. I'm glad to know you're alive and well and still out there trying to do justice and right the world somehow.
Well, and you really set a great standard. When you came into Congress, you were a woman who didn't take lightly the stodgy old male environment there. And you became quite a target for the right. Rush Limbaugh in particular loved to attack you as a feminazi. And when you ran for president in 1988, you were subjected to quite a bit of ridicule from the Reagan turning into the Bush message machine. And we invited you to talk today because as a member of the Common Cause Governing Board, you have been talking to people all over the country in the aftermath of the attempted murder of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords in Tucson, Arizona, just about 10 days ago. And I just wanted to get your initial reaction as a woman who really was on the front lines and who was subjected to many kinds of ridicule and threats from the political opposition and also from the kind of freelance commentators who are loosely aligned with the political opposition. I wanted to get your thoughts about what happened and what it means to us as a nation.
Well, you know, Gabby is a good friend, and I had gone down this fall to campaign for her. And you're right about my history. We had lots of toxicity around all of my campaigns. There were an awful lot of guys who just absolutely went nuts at the mere sound of my voice or the mere mention of my name. But I must say, Arizona, the toxicity was even worse than I had seen in my time. So when I heard that all of this happened, sadly, I have to say, I'm not terribly surprised. I mean, there were hundreds of people that would come outside her office every day and scream and holler epithets 24/7, mm-hmm. whether it was about immigrants or whether it was about health care or whether it was about anything. And, you know, yeah, reasonable people understand there's a difference between shouting terrible things and shooting bullets, but not everybody's reasonable, and you find somebody who's obviously got some mental health issues. And, you know, that kind of toxicity certainly doesn't help. It feeds it. So I wasn't surprised when I heard it. It made me very, very sad. And it made me really ponder, how in the world have we gotten to this place? When I was elected, we were in the middle of impeachment. There was a Vietnam War. We had very aggressive debates, and people had very strong opinions. But at the end of the day, we'd still sit down with each other and talk.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just all gone. It's now, you know, team Republican or team Democrat, and you don't cross the aisle. And if you do, what's wrong with you? It's a very sad place.
And Congresswoman, when you talk about the toxicity in Arizona, I think a lot of people are trying to separate this event from the obvious issues that have been raised there, the demonization of people without documents, and the 1080 law that allows police to stop anybody who appears to be a non-citizen and demand their papers. And this came out of a whole, I mean, many Americans aren't really aware of the climate there, but like many states, Arizona is broke, and they are making very difficult decisions. We know that Governor Jan Brewer has been criticized because she cut out or she approved the reduction in health care services, including much-needed organ transplants for patients. And the diversion of 1080 and immigrant bashing was used by members of the legislature to try to distract people from the economic problems and the difficult choices that they had to make. And in many respects, this has spun out of control, even separate from the Giffords incident there. Raul Grijalva, a more progressive and I don't know how to put this, but as a Hispanic American, he really stands out in Arizona. And he was threatened. His office was attacked. A white powder was mailed to his office, all just before this fall's election.
Absolutely. He almost didn't win.
Yeah.
It was very sad.
And so this political climate, even if the young man accused of these shootings, who has been excessively profiled in the media in the last week or so, you know, he does appear to be a deranged lone gunman. But that does not mean that we shouldn't address the very serious and toxic political climate that's been created in our country.
No, I totally agree. You know, it goes back to the Romans. This is a political tactic that was used by the Romans, where when they had to do tough things, they diverted people's attentions with circuses. But we now are doing an entirely different kind of a circus. It's kind of a hate party, and getting people worked into a real froth. The talk about we ought to have a revolution and we ought to, you know, lock and load and crosshairs and all of those things. If you remember, when we used to talk back in the 90s, most of the analogies were to sports or to things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember people using guns and, you know, war and all of that as an analogy for any kind of a political action.
Well, do you think that some of this evolved from the wars of the last 10 years and American nationalism and the way the media covered those as an us versus them sports-like frame?
I think part of it is the Cold War was easier for Americans because the world was in two things, and it was like we defined ourselves by what we were against. We were against Russia and people on her side. After the Cold War, we had to start thinking about what we're for, and an awful lot of people, you know, we also were seeing the demographics change very seriously in this country, and the idea that, you know, you have an African-American male as president, you have women in high-powered positions, you have Hispanics in high-powered positions, that is just awfully threatening to people. And I think that's a lot of what the code of "we want our country back" is about. Nobody invaded our country. So when you say "we want our country back," the normal definition, it just doesn't work.
Well, and it's interesting, Congresswoman, because during the Bush years, I attended a series of conferences in Washington called Take Back America. Mm-hmm. And they were run by progressive Democrats who were responding to the extremes of the Bush administration and the Republican majorities that they enjoyed during most of the 2 terms that Bush served. And it strikes me as interesting that now that there is a black guy and Democrats in control in Washington, that the same frame is being used from the flip side.
Isn't it though?
But the message that progressives had in taking back America was to restore constitutional rule and our Fourth Amendment rights, to get us out of illegal wars and misadventures on Islamic soil. And so it is ironic in many ways to see how this has flipped and how quickly it happened.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah, I mean it's really incredible. And I also think that the internet, we all talk about it. The internet allows people to just search sites that agree with them, and we now have whole channels that only put out one side of the argument, and really will go to such extremes. I mean, they make up stuff, the death squads, the things that they will put in there that just plain aren't true. And yet, if folks hear it on the radio or TV, they assume it is.
And Congresswoman, when you and I last spoke in the 1990s, I was hosting a daily radio show on a major station in San Francisco, and I had the dubious honor of following Rush Limbaugh every day. And I now relish that time period because after that, people like me were squeezed out of the radio media, because the owners found out they could make more money by putting on Rush, followed by Rush Jr., followed by Rush the Third, followed by the Rush wannabe of the moment.
Right.
And so we've had this these parallel media universes, and they now are populated by separate sets of facts.
That's right. So really, they aren't facts at all. I mean, it's everybody just putting their spin, let's face it. They're just spin doctors out there spinning whatever it takes to try and get people stirred up. And I guess it's about ratings. I don't know. I'm not in the media, so it's hard for me to figure out what it is. But somehow, apparently, people are much more apt to tune in if you're getting them all exercised and angry, because then they have to tune in the next day to find out how much worse the next day is than the day before, and so forth and so on. I don't know why that's so appealing to people. I can't tolerate listening to it more than 2 seconds, and I'm ready to turn it off. But
well,
for some people, there is great, they really like to get all worked up,
Well, just a quick explanation from the media perspective, Congresswoman, and that is that the conservative talk shows draw small but loyal audiences. And these are people who report to the ratings agencies that they listen to every minute of Rush's program every day, whether they in fact actually accomplish that or not. And so there's a new system now where they're using meters, people meters they're called, and it's actually shown a sharp reduction in the total number of people who listen to conservative talk and to the amount of time that they spend doing it.
Oh, Peter, that's the best news I've heard in years, really.
But under the previous method, which was a paper diary, people would what we call over-report. Limbaugh's only on 3 hours a day, but some people would say, oh, I listened to him for 5 hours.
Yeah, isn't that something? Well, you have made my day. I'm going to go out and do a little happy dance in the yard when this is over or something. No, I'm happy to hear that because, as you well know, it's just gotten more and more and more incendiary. And I remember one guy in my area, and I kept thinking they ought to be able to do something about it, but he'd say, you can't stand Schroeder? Let me tell you what to do. you get a gun, you get in your car, now you figure it out, you know? And you think, well, that's about as graphic as you can get.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and yet they'd say, well, you know, it's just free speech. And, I didn't really think that he had that much free speech.
Well, one of the most callous and graphic things that Limbaugh did was in the spring of 2008. He claims that he was just expressing wishful thinking, but he talked about his hopes that somebody would bring a gun to the Democratic convention in Denver.
Oh, I remember that.
In 2008. And, he routinely says these things with the utmost seriousness. And then when he's challenged, he says, oh, I'm just an entertainer. I was just kidding.
Yeah, everybody knows I'm kidding. Yeah, well, I don't think those people that listen to him know they're kidding. And I do think there's another thing. I have a good friend who's a psychiatrist at Harvard, and she said many of her friends have sat around and said, you know, pre-Reagan, we thought of America as a family where you tried to help people in the shadows of their life or in the sunset of their life or in the sunrise, you know, the people who need help. And starting with Reagan, it became, this is America and we're winners. You know, America's number one, we're winners, so forth and so on. So if you are an American and you don't think you're a winner, then you got to have some reason why you weren't a winner, because this is really awful. Because you're supposed to be a winner because you're an American.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when you start ranting and raving and railing about all these other things that are out there, whether it's, you know, whoever it is of the day, the immigrants of the day or the, you know, there's always some cause of the moment. That.
Well, and I'm glad you recalled that because he also used the image of the welfare queen.
Exactly.
As a very rich target.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because when he said welfare queen, his supporters imagined a black female.
That's exactly right.
Who had 9 children with 8 different men and was gaming the system. She was enjoying being on welfare. That was the image. Mm-hmm. And Congresswoman, correct me if I'm wrong, but at that very time in the 1980s, the number of people on welfare who were white was well into the majority. I recall it was 62%.
Oh, yeah.
Somewhere around 1985 or 1987, when Reagan was really demonizing Americans on welfare.
Oh, there's no question about it. And I remember, too, the state of Idaho, some of the young women who were on welfare because they suddenly were a single parent or whatever, made a little film for Congress and for their own legislature saying, you know, this is Idaho. I don't think we have an African-American on welfare in the entire state. Would you please look at our faces? You know, let us tell you our stories. So, yeah, no, that really became a them and us, and it started, I think, then, and it's just worked into an art form since then.
Congresswoman Pat Schroeder, retired, is with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And Congresswoman, I think most Americans were really touched by the speech that President Obama gave in Tucson last week. And I think that most people got a strong sense of the civility and the bipartisanship that I have often criticized on a policy basis, because I feel the president has given away a lot to the right without really balancing that in delivering to his progressive base. The exception really is don't ask, don't tell. And I have very mixed feelings about the health care insurance reform, because for me it didn't go far enough.
I'm with you there.
That said, tell me how you reacted to the president's speech, and if you think that some of the most virulent Republicans will take the speech into account and change their behavior, or if they will simply kind of go underground for a little while and then return to their previous routines.
Well, sadly, I think that this option is B. You know, they will smile for a while and then, boom, they'll be right back to where it is because divisiveness has been working for them. And, you know, at the end of the day, they want to win and they're going to do what they think works for them. And they're going to keep doing it until that doesn't work for them anymore. You know how everybody in a poll says they hate negative campaigns? Well, guess what? Negative campaigns keep winning. So that just could be why we keep seeing them, and they get more and more negative.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you about the mixed messages that I'm getting right now from John Boehner and the House Republican leadership. They are offering the idea that for the State of the Union message, instead of sitting aisle by aisle with Republicans on one side and Democrats on the other, they're going to mix it up. Now, that's an interesting, nice little gesture, and I have no opposition to it whatsoever. At the same time, they continue to promote this idea that they can repeal so-called Obamacare. And this is an effort that is driven by the polls and by their desire to pander to the Republican base. But recent polls show that the opposition to the health care reform, even though you and I aren't that happy with it, is kind of receding. And most Democrats are now falling in line and saying, well, I support the president. The reform was a mixed bag, but I certainly don't support repeal.
Well, that's exactly right. And plus, if you remember Boehner's big opening address, it was about how all the rules were going to be open and on and on and on. Well, they're going to bring up the health care bill, and you're going to get to either vote for it or against it. They're not going to try and perfect it. It's just, you know, either shoot it down or let it go. That's ridiculous. So what happened to his promise a week ago? They've also done away with the pay-as-you-go thing for all their whining and crying about how expensive and the overspending of Obama. They now changed it so that you can do tax cuts without paying for them. So there goes the debt again. This is how we got into the hole with the Reagan or the Bush tax cuts.
Well, you don't seem to understand, even with all your experience, that tax cuts generate more revenue.
Absolutely.
And that you do not have to account for spending on the Defense Department, on wars that were funded off the books, and that really social programs are the only thing that can be cut. This is all based on the Republican worldview.
That's exactly right, and it's all you-know-what. I mean, it's all woo-woo. Part of the reason the deficit looks so bad now is because the president was honest enough to move back on budget. Hello? I think that we were running wars off budget. It was just, what a joke. And of course, the tax cuts continue on. You know, I think Obama is, I really feel for him. I'm sure he gets up many a day and wonders, what in the world did he get himself into? And I think he really thought he could charm Republicans. I, like you, got very frustrated when he kept going over and trying to court them, going to their caucuses, going to their conferences, and then they come right out and kick him like a soccer ball. And you begin to think, is he a slow learner or what? You know.
Well, and Congresswoman, it actually caused me to build on something that you're somewhat famous for. You were the one who tagged Ronald Reagan as the Teflon president.
Mm-hmm.
And my little joke is that DuPont created the new and improved Leflon, and that President Obama has been using it. And nothing that comes to him from the left sticks.
No, he just goes right by him. So I've been very frustrated by that. But I did think that the tone of his address was phenomenal. I'm going to be very interested to see what he has to say in the State of the Union. I keep hoping that he's going to learn that the Republicans just aren't on the level. I mean, they aren't there to govern. They're there to destroy everything.
And Congresswoman, this brings me next to his call for civility. And I certainly want that, and in an ideal world, I'd see it as a worthwhile thing to strive for. But I believe that all the pokes in the eye start on the right, and that while we do have some fringe lefties and Democrats who are irresponsible and use invective and a lot of name-calling, there is no equivalency. You know, liberals like me are outnumbered in the talk radio game 9-1. And that's a generous calculation.
Oh, I agree.
And so we have, you know, 9 hours of name-calling and, you know, misleading spinning of the facts to promote the conservative talking point of the day generated from Fox News. And then we have a lot of, you know, very independent people on the left who are attempting to respond to that, but without the systematic coordination and without the funding, and the number of media outlets that the right enjoys. So I'm having a hard time accepting the prescription offered by the president because, number one, I don't believe the right will stand down. And number two, as I said, I don't think there is currently an equivalency. And if there is going to be a change in tone, it has to start with responsibility from Fox News and the people that it feeds talking points to.
Well, I totally agree. I get very frustrated even with the more mainstream media because they still have some feeling that everything's got to be fair. So you take 500 outrageous statements by the Republicans, and if they can find one outrageous statement by a Democrat somewhere, they'll play that over and over and over and over again, saying, well, see, they both do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And what we're saying is, let's look at the magnitude of it on both sides. The gravitas on the other side is so much more weighty. And obviously, we can't control everything everybody does, but In fact, in the Democratic Party, we can't control anything.
Right.
We're not an organized party, I don't think. It's very frustrating to me that we just don't seem to ever be able to get together and produce a message and stay with it. You know, we tend to be more wonkish. Instead of wanting to do a bumper sticker slogan or something that works in the seven-second soundbite world that we live in, people want to sit down and explain to you the whole thing.
I just think that it's so terribly, terribly important that people understand that on our side, that the average American is not going to sit and listen to a 15-minute explanation about a policy. They just aren't. We just seem to all be suffering from attention deficit disorder in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how we get out of that box.
Well, Congresswoman, I want to point out an excellent commentary piece that was posted at Alternet, and I'll put up a link on the show file at peterbcollins.com. But I want to credit the writer Melissa McEwen, who made a long list of why there is no real equivalency between the media pundits on the right and those on the left. And while most people are focused on the hockey mom from Wasilla, to me, The real threat is Glenn Beck, and this is a guy who has equated universal health care to rape. He jokes about victims of forest fires being American-hating liberals. He compared Al Gore to Hitler. He's condoned the murder of Michael Moore. He's accused George Soros, the Holocaust survivor, of being a Nazi collaborator. He's joked about poisoning Nancy Pelosi and essentially conducted that mock execution on his show. He's equated immigration reform with burning U.S. citizens alive. And we had an incident here in the San Francisco area last summer where a guy named Byron Williams came to San Francisco from a remote mountain area of the state because he had been listening to Glenn Beck demonize the Tides Foundation, which is a liberal foundation based in San Francisco. And I have friends who work there. And he was inadvertently stopped by police for a traffic violation before he got to San Francisco. But he was heavily armed, and it's very clear that he was inspired by Glenn Beck to take on this vigilante mission. And so, irrespective of what happened to Congresswoman Giffords and the others at the meet and greet in Arizona, we have a very critical problem. And before I get your response, I just want to add that I do not say that Glenn Beck should be denied the right to spew what he does. I believe the First Amendment protects him. I believe that the network that he's on has a responsibility to at least balance the inflammatory remarks that he makes or identify them in some manner. Because for him to go and have an hour a day unresponded to present these extreme views is very dangerous, and it's counterproductive to what remains of our democracy.
Well, I totally agree. I think we all, as citizens, need to sit down and think of what is a way to balance that type of rhetoric. First of all, you know, there is no absolute amendment in the Constitution. Even free speech, you're not allowed to stand up in a crowded place and scream fire if there's no fire, because you could stampede people. And there's a point where you begin to wonder when some of this speech becomes so incendiary that it becomes close to that standing up in a crowded place and screaming fire, because they just keep putting gas on the fire constantly. But whether it is making them put on countervailing views, which I think is a wonderful idea, or what it is, I don't know. But these were public airways to begin with. This is where they got their licenses from the public. And it seems to me they're not serving the public when they allow that kind of rhetoric to go unchecked or unquestioned, where it just goes on and on and keeps, you know, spewing at you like a fire hose.
Well, and one of the reasons for that is that cable channels are not regulated and are not covered by the Communications Act of 1934 as the broadcast radio and television outlets are. The other issue is that the whole rise of Rush Limbaugh was based on Reagan's repeal or just dissolution of the so-called Fairness Doctrine. And Congresswoman, while it was a little bit impractical at the time to try to provide immediate balance for every viewpoint that was offered on a program, it was the right idea, and it's the right constitutional framework, in my opinion.
I think so, too. I've heard that, you know, the British have a different system where they insist that there has to be balance on their airways, be they cable or be they broadcast. And I think that's the right way to go. I've talked to many British visitors here who are just appalled. They're like, my goodness, we have nothing like this over there. This would be just terrible. If you're going to have a liberal, you've got to have a conservative. You also, what you've done is now you look at the British, and they've been able to put a liberal-conservative government together, doing things we may agree or disagree with, but nobody's screaming capitulation. The problem here is we've got it so polarized and so divisive that everybody now believes that if you try to compromise, you've totally capitulated and you ought to be shot too. You've sold out. This is terrible. You're awful. I never want to hear from you again. So by not having both sides being aired in the same channel, people are only getting the one, and they just believe that you're supposed to go just stand for that no matter what happens. If the whole country goes down the chute, so be it. We're going to stand for what's right and justice in our own view. So we really need to look more at other countries and how they solve this and or how they deal with it, because we're not doing well at all.
And I've been disappointed that the Obama FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, while they're attempting to maintain net neutrality in some fashion, I don't see that they've taken on the issues that are clearly under their purview. Net neutrality, the courts have raised some issues about whether the FCC really has jurisdiction. But there's no question that it has jurisdiction over the licensed radio and television stations. And I believe that when the Democrats had the majorities in the House and close to 60 votes in the Senate, that they should have moved for reform of the media regulations so that cable lives under the same regulatory framework as broadcast.
Oh, I'm telling you, we tried. There was a hardcore of us that would put bills out like that, and even John Dingell was supportive. We would get absolutely killed. I'm telling you, every cable operator from your district, every person who owned a broadcast station came at you hammer and tong, mm-hmm. and scared everybody to death.
Now, could you tone down that rhetoric? You just used killed and hammered and tong.
Yeah, well, we were. I'm sorry. I'm here in preaching civility and not practicing. I'm sorry. But they really came at us full on and said, don't you dare. Don't mm-hmm. you dare do this. So we couldn't get any decent co-sponsorship. There was just no way to pass it.
Yeah. Let me close by asking you about a place where you started at the National Labor Relations Board. And President Obama came into office promising to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, and there's been no action on that, and clearly no political capital from the White House was expended on it. How do you see the imbalance between management and labor today and the unwillingness of the Democrats to really address that?
Well, there again, you've got this huge problem of so many people not understanding what that was about and the distortions of it, and our side just running scared. You could not. The bills were introduced, but you couldn't get enough sponsorship to pass it. You know, think about this. If you are a member of a union, you are subsidizing everybody in that unit, because for the 49% that may decide not to join and not to pay dues and not to do the heavy lifting, under the law, the union has to cover them too. Yeah, how fair is that? And I just think that the whole, it is so skewed towards management and has been so twisted, especially during the Bush years. They just gutted the NLRB. It's going to take a very long time for it to come back. And as a consequence, we don't have a very strong union movement. So you don't have the strength in the union movement you used to have. So they don't have the power they used to have. And the other side is scooped up all of that power and has come back at 100 miles an hour. We play with this myth that everybody sits down and negotiates with their employer when they go to work. And we know what a joke that is.
Well, and I feel that the media is part of this as well, that labor unions have been marginalized because the most extreme negative aspects of unions are blown out of proportion and made to seem to represent the full spectrum of organized labor and collective bargaining.
Yeah.
And the other impression, I think, is that, and it's particularly rampant here in California, Congresswoman, where people who work in Silicon Valley think that they are about to get rich, that, mm-hmm. that they're going to be the next Google millionaire or billionaire, and therefore they align their interests with people who don't have their best interests at heart.
Right.
And they imagine, you know, well, I'm going to be rich and, you know, driving a fancy car really soon, and therefore I don't want the tax cuts for the top 2% extended.
Right.
And Tom Frank wrote so beautifully about this in What's the Matter with Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
But we see that compounded now, where people really do vote against their self-interest, and it's driven by media spin and this fantasy that they're about to become the next Warren Buffett.
Oh, there's no question. And that's been so for a very long time. In Texas, you never used to be able to tax the oil companies because everybody thought they were going to strike oil on their property the next day. It's really amazing how Americans so totally buy into that dream and don't really look at the reality of it. And it's fed. I mean, the other side has figured this out and plays on that constantly. You know, you may be rich or you may be an entrepreneur, and do you want to deal with unions? No way. So they play that game, too. But I remember even unions used to vote against me because they would say, I have to vote for my gun,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, it's abortion or something.
Yeah.
So they've been really good at finding some issue that will cause people to vote against their own self-interest.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Well, Congresswoman, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today, and thank you for your comments. I hope you're enjoying your retirement.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's been wonderful to touch base again. Good luck to you.
Congresswoman Pat Schroeder here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And the Peter B. Collins Show continues, sponsored by Cinema Classics, the movie company specializing in classic Hollywood and foreign films. Check out their 30% off sale right now. Just click on the link at peterbcollins.com. And we'll spot the shipping to you, too. It's free if you just enter PBC in the comments section of the website order form.
The country I come from is called the Midwest. I was raised and brought up there, lost to buy.
That's Bob Dylan's tune, God on Our Side, updated in the 80s by a San Francisco band called Wire Train. And it plays us into our second segment today as investigative reporter Jason Leopold returns. He's deputy managing editor at truthout.org and does a lot of great investigative work that makes him a regular contributor on our program. Jason, welcome as always.
Hey, Peter. Good to be back with you.
And you have been working on the what I call the God Squad in the military issue for a number of years now, and you and I both are connected with Mikey Weinstein, who is a former judge advocate general in the Air Force. Two of his sons and a daughter-in-law went to the Air Force Academy, and the imposition of Christian-based religion on his Jewish children, I don't know about the daughter-in-law, led him to form the Military Religious Freedom Foundation.
Yeah.
And I credit Mikey as a former, I believe he was in the Reagan White House, is not a dangerous liberal or a wacky leftist, but he's a principled American who really believes in the church of separation of church and state and in both freedom of and freedom from religion. And he his group has exposed a great deal of troubling issues in the Air Force Academy and more widespread in the U.S. military rather broadly. And that is that it has become a Christianist organization over the last 10 years or so.
Right.
And this followed the scandals of Tailhook in the Navy and the sexual harassment and rape of women attending the Air Force Academy in the 1990s. So it's kind of a breathtaking shift. But you have reported in an exclusive report that was published on the 5th of January, and I'll link to it in the show file related to this podcast, about even more troubling issues where we have a program that's funded with $125 million of my taxpayer money called Comprehensive Soldier Fitness. And essentially what you report is that there is extreme pressure on members of the military to express spirituality and pick a religion, essentially, while the military doesn't foist a particular religion and the language is scrubbed enough to avoid promoting Jesus or a specific form of religious expression. It's very clear that atheists are under a lot of pressure now to conform and to become part of what I call the God Squad in the military today. So, first of all, tell us about CSF,
sure.
Comprehensive Soldier Fitness.
Well, you know, this story, Peter, is a multi-layered story. So, I'll go in stages here. The first is this program, Comprehensive Soldier Fitness, which is basically a resilience program using the concepts and theories and practices of a movement called positive psychology to make soldiers more emotionally, mentally resilient. And this was enacted, put together as a way, as one way of dealing with the high number of post-traumatic stress disorder cases, suicides that have become an epidemic within mm-hmm. the military, due largely, if not entirely, to multiple deployments that soldiers that has affected soldiers. So, you know, instead of actually, you know, putting that money into resources such as hiring mental health, you know, counselors, officials, they've put together a program called Comprehensive Soldier Fitness in which every U.S. Army soldier must take take an assessment of themselves. And that assessment is in five different categories. It's physical, it's emotional, it's family, spiritual, and I think I may be leaving one out.
Psychological.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, what this consists of is a bunch of questions, more than 100 questions online. And again, it's part of this positive psychology movement where they're, you know, they're on the spiritual end, which is what has raised the ire of people like Mikey Weinstein, there are questions like, you know, I feel connected to all humanity. There are questions that relate to, you know, having a belief in a higher power. And, you know, for me, I have to say, when I started researching this, the tests themselves really were very similar to what I would call the, you know, the personality tests that are given by the Church of Scientology.
That was exactly what was on my mind. Go ahead.
Yeah, it seems very similar to that, and I've done some, you know, some research on that in the past. So, you know, this area of spiritual, and I should say that the tests, you know, soldiers are rated based on their answers from a, one to five, you know, saying in which their answers would say this, you know, this is very much like me to this is not like me at all. And if you score below a certain level, sometimes you'll receive, you answer these questions, you click the button, you immediately get your response. And sometimes if the, you know, if the answers in certain categories, if they fall below a certain threshold, it will say that this is an area in which you need improvement. You are emotionally unfit. In the spiritual category, it would say that spiritual fitness is an area of concern.
Mm-hmm.
You're more or less spiritually unfit, and you should address that. And address that through remedial training, mandatory remedial training. Although the Army now says, particularly after this story I had published came out, that you know, the spiritual aspect is voluntary. It's not mandatory. It's just recommended. So, you know, again, this is $125 million in which we are asking soldiers who are, let's face it, Peter, they're trained to kill. We're at a war, right? We're asking them if they feel all connected to all humanity. This is appears to be some sort of kind of brainwashing technique.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly comes off that way. And, you know, the program is based on a program that came out of the University of Pennsylvania's Positive Psychology Center.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's been a lot of research conducted on this type of, you know, resiliency training that has been conducted in schools, largely with elementary school children, that if you sort of, you know, provide them with these positive thinking techniques, that they'll grow into adults being able to easily handle life's challenges. There's no evidence, however, that such a program would work for certainly for the 1.1 million U.S. Army soldiers, and for, you know, adults in a, you know, combat environment.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very much, again, despite the Army's denials, an experiment, a research program, in which the officials and psychologists who are responsible for developing this program and advising the Department of Defense are using the data that they collect to inform how, you know, their pet project will work.
Mm-hmm.
And the spiritual component, the remedial training that is required or that's recommended, as the Army would say, you know, it contains religious imagery. So, for example, they'll show U.S. soldiers standing in a circle praying, They will show a flag folding ceremony, which is very much a based on Christian ideology and fundamentalist Christian ideology, and they'll come up with all of these images that certainly would give an atheist soldier, foxhole atheist, the feeling that they are being pressured into accepting some sort of organized religion or belief system, and are hiding under the cover of the army that is spirituality, it's more New Agey, if you will. Mm-hmm.
Now, Jason, in just a second, I want you to tell us about Sergeant Justin Griffith, who you profile and quote in the article. But I want to come back to something you said a moment ago, because I think you know, and many listeners know, I was raised a Catholic. I'm still recovering, and I'm in the agnostic zone somewhere. I respect people and their spiritual pursuits, and those who have a faith and practice it, I respect, and they have the right to do that just as I have the right not to. But there is a fundamental contradiction here of being a killing machine for God or Jesus or for an unspecified higher power. And it really strikes me that this is a troubling aspect, that it's not that I want to just, train humans like pit bulls and not allow them to develop psychologically or even spiritually if that is their choice, but to have programmed spirituality, even if it's absent explicit religious messages, is a fundamental contradiction of the mission of an organized military.
Right. Absolutely. And, as you indicated at the, in discussing this during the introduction, is the military, certainly during the launch of the Iraq War and invasion of Afghanistan, there has been the pressure on soldiers to convert to fundamentalist Christianity has been enormous. We've seen a meteoric rise in that type of pressure, and largely it is happening as a result of the chaplains who practice a certain form of Christianity, which requires them to evangelize and proselytize as part of their belief system, and it's important to note that this is unconstitutional. The Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution states that there shall be no religious test. There's simply no place for it in the U.S. military, and yet, certainly as Mikey Weinstein has discovered, and the investigations his organization have conducted over the years, it's widespread, and it's being greenlit by the highest levels of the U.S. government within the Pentagon.
And not only that, Jason, this is politically toxic, in my view, at a time when our so-called enemies are Islamic fundamentalists who, to the extent they're aware of these issues and have a perception that they are facing a Christian army, it simply adds fuel to their fires. We're putting out a fire with religious gasoline here. And this is, it seems to be so ill-considered, unconstitutional, and can be arbitrary in the way it's imposed on individuals who choose not to be spiritual or religious.
Right, yes. And, it's important to note that at least within the, this latest incident, the, the spiritual fitness part of this program, there are about more than 200 active duty, U.S. soldiers who have contacted the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, and I have spoken to some of them, and some of them are practicing Christians, and they are upset about this. I do want to note, by the way, that mm-hmm. Mikey Weinstein is also a member of Truth Out's Board of Advisors.
Okay,
and I just want to provide that full disclosure
mm-hmm.
there.
That's fine.
And I have, you know, spoken to some of these, some of these soldiers, and they're just upset by it simply because, well, first of all, they do feel that it's, you know, some sort of a religious test, that the immediately when they hear spiritual, you know, they think the spirit, they think that it has religious connotations. And I have to say, I certainly can't blame them. Now, I live in L.A., Peter, so, you know, I have to say that many people who I encountered have a very different, you know, opinion of what the word spiritual means.
Sure.
You know, very New Agey, but all of it, you know, some people think that, you know, believe that, oh, a higher power, the tree is my higher power.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is, it has truly angered U.S. soldiers, you know, some of them who say that, you know, that this is ridiculous, that it's actually having, in some cases, an opposite effect. They're feeling, you know, very happy and confident, and they take this, you know, test, and they're saying, oh, you're spiritually unfit. And they actually read that as saying that I'm spiritually unfit. I'm unfit to be a U.S. soldier. So it's somewhat having a depressing, you know, they're feeling a bit depressed by that.
Now tell us about Sergeant Justin Griffith.
Well, Sergeant Justin Griffith, he's 27 years old, based out of Fort Bragg, North Carolina, married, and this is the second time he's taken this test. He took it recently, late last year, and, you know, he would describe himself as a, you know, a foxhole atheist. You know, does not believe in the spirit or any sort of organized religion. And, you know, he took this test and was presented with a number of questions in which he basically, you know, responded on the spiritual component part of it that, you know, these questions such as, I am a spiritual person, my life has lasting meaning, I believe that in some way my life is closely connected to all humanity and all the world. You know, he answered, yes, it describes me, but for the most part, at least to one of them, but for the most part, he said, no, this is, you know, this does not describe me at all. And so after he completed his test, he immediately received a response that advised him that spiritual fitness is an area of possible difficulty for you. And then the computer said that you may lack a sense of meaning and purpose in your life. That's because of the way he responded to those questions. You may lack a sense of meaning and purpose in your life. At times, it is hard for you to make sense of what is happening to you and others around you. You may not feel connected to something larger than yourself. You may question your beliefs, principles, and values. And you know, Justin was outraged by this, truly outraged. He felt that, well, you know, this was not even a person, a computer basically telling him that his life has no meaning.
Yeah, based on a multiple choice quiz.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, so he was upset about it. He felt that, first of all, that did not just, you know, that's certainly not how he felt. You know, he did not feel that, you know, he had any issues to be concerned about. And he was quite upset by the, you know, fact that the, you know, test found him spiritual unfit, gave him a red bar, you know, warning him that this is an area of concern, that you know, take some remedial training, go through these online courses. And, you know, he eventually contacted the Military Religious Freedom Foundation because he felt that these questions were so blatantly, at least to him, religious, that the words spiritual were simply a cover for religion. And, you know, those training modules, as I indicated, you know, they do discuss, you know, meditation and, you know, some things like that. But for the most part, it's showing U.S. soldiers standing around in a circle praying. And in fact, on the of a screen capture of this test, of the spiritual component part of it, which shows U.S. soldiers standing around in a circle praying. Now, if any person were to look at that, I certainly think that that's exactly what they would think, is that this is religious.
Well, and we know that this is a group standing in a circle holding hands.
Exactly.
We know, for example, that that's not how Muslims pray. Okay?
Yeah.
So the image right away sends a signal that this is probably Christian. I don't think Jews typically pray in that manner either. But you know, this is bizarre on so many levels, Jason.
Right.
And to imagine that, you know, our military, take, for example, the concept of unit cohesion. This was one of the canards that was promoted as a reason why we can't allow gays to openly serve in the military.
Right.
Well, I'm sorry, but the intrusiveness of these enforced religious experiences or evaluations really promote a kind of division where, you know, Christians have unit cohesion, but those who don't want to join the prayer circle, therefore, are kind of excluded from the unit. And if unit cohesion was so important in the debate over gays in the military,
right,
how can we put that aside when it comes to a much more personal and, you know, inappropriate issues for the military to be involved with in any way, shape, or form?
Right, right. It's a good question, and it seems like it's a, you know, it's pretty evident that the military, you know, continues to struggle with this. I mean, it's so funny because they're simply just making it, you know, much more difficult for themselves by, you know, introducing these frankly, controversial, you know, programs and policies. You know, let me just also add that spiritual fitness in general is has been a policy of the armies, at least, you know, going back a few decades, actually, back to the 80s. And I think that there is a, if I'm not mistaken, I don't have the exact policy in front of me, but it's on paper, and it's something that the military, you know, when they first introduced it, said that's, you know, that an area that they want to focus on. But, you know, again, we're talking about, you know, certainly over the past 8 years, and I've reported extensively on this, that it has not been about, you know, spiritual, you know, meditation or breathing exercises or things of that nature. It has been about religion, and that's largely why, you know, many people who have been paying close attention to the wars have seen this as a war where you have Jesus versus Muhammad. You know, we know that the, you know, very right-wing fundamentalist Christian organizations have been given carte blanche to proselytize within the area of combat, to hold you know, a wide range of events that you know, they're out there on the campus of the you know, Air Force Academy. So this just happens to be more evident, and yet the Army, you know, excuse the pun, continues to shoot itself in the foot by, you know, putting this kind of pressure on soldiers. And as I indicated, Peter, you know, PTSD, traumatic brain injury, and the suicides are truly an epidemic. And during the years, you know, during George Bush's tenure, you know, the government did absolutely nothing, frankly, to to address this. And in fact, they cut funding from, you know, the VA after soldiers returned, made it very difficult for them to get any, you know, real help. And we're seeing these numbers dramatically increase. And, you know, basically what the Army is now saying is think good thoughts. You know, you're in a war zone, think positively. Some of the examples that these folks give the Army officials are that you're in a war zone. Your comrade does not make it back in time. Instead of thinking that he got blown to bits, think that maybe he stopped on his way back to grab a bag of potato chips. So it's really trying to change the way people, think. Trying to, what's the Bobby McFerrin song? Don't worry, be happy. And that's costing taxpayers $125 million. And then on top of it, you add, while we're at it, why don't we just throw in this, spiritual part, and we'll get to, follow through with our real mission as well. And I also just want to add one more thing, is that in the research I've conducted, and I've conducted so much research on this particular, aspect of the program, the papers, the peer-reviewed journals that the psychologists at the University of Pennsylvania and the Army have cited actually made a point of saying it's very difficult to distinguish between religion and spirituality, that those two words are so closely connected that it's very difficult to sort of separate them out and let people feel that or lead them to believe that there's another meaning.
And Jason, that is contradicted by the quotes that you have here from the woman who directs the program.
Yes.
And let me just say that I was relieved that it's not General Boykin, the Bible thumper from the Bush era,
right.
who's
That's
running
right.
this program. But her name is Brigadier General Rhonda Cornum. You say she's a nutritionist and urologist who's directing the program. I won't touch those qualifications. But you quote her, "The program measures a person's core values and beliefs concerning their meaning and purpose in life. It's not religious, although a person's religion can still affect those things. Spiritual training is entirely optional, unlike the other domains. Every time you say the S-P-I-R word, you're going to get sued. So that part is not mandatory. The assessment is mandatory, though, and junior soldiers will be required to take exercises to strengthen their other four domains." Now, this is a bullshit. It's verbal gymnastics.
Right.
And you just pointed out that the University of Pennsylvania, and listeners who are getting outraged will get even more outraged when we go into that in a moment. But this is incoherent. And we know that they are using spirituality as a proxy for religion and for Christianity in particular, because they know that they would cross a line and get in a whole lot of legal trouble if they did that. But this is skirting right up to the edge of the law, and as it's practiced and as it impacts people who profess no faith, even if they don't define themselves as full-blown atheists, is clearly unconstitutional to this set of eyeballs.
Right. Yes, and I think that that's the point that the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. I want to add that along with Mikey Weinstein's group and Justin Griffith, Truth Out has also joined on a Freedom of Information Act request filed by the law firm Jones Day up in San Francisco, seeking documents, emails, anything that would further explain how the spiritual component was put together, the contracts that were given to the various individuals and universities to help create this program, because as I indicated earlier, Peter, this is such a multi-layered story, because I haven't even gotten into the part where person who inspired it is one of the advisors of Comprehensive Soldier Fitness, and the father of the positive psychology movement is a man named Martin Seligman,
mm-hmm.
whose work in an area called learned helplessness back in the 60s was the inspiration for the CIA's torture program. And Martin Seligman, back in 2001, December of 2001, exactly at the same time, Peter, that the Defense Department started contacting military officials and psychologists associated with the Joint Personnel Recovery Agency and the Survival Evasion Resistance and Escape Fear Program.
Right.
When the Defense Department contacted them, Martin Seligman had a meeting at his house where the two people, the two psychologists credited with the torture program, James Mitchell, creating the techniques within the program, James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, along with a man named Kirk Hubbard, the CIA's top behavioral psychologist, and some Israeli intelligence officer, they met at Martin Seligman's house.
Now, I just have to interject here. This guy Hubbard, no relation to L. Ron.
It's not as far as I know.
Okay.
Not as far as I know. But that's actually a good question. Here's a person who, and by the way, he received, just as another aside, he and his university received $31 million last year, a no-bid contract, sole source, no-bid contract by the Defense Department to train U.S. Army officers in what's referred to as master resilience trainers to basically, hold these sort of workshops and turning them into, this is my word, pseudo psychologists, some sort of experts in this area, so they can sort of pass this down to soldiers at the various bases, such as Fort Bragg or Fort Jackson.
So let me just recap this to underscore for our listeners. Dr. Martin Seligman, so-called Dr. Happy, is connected to the people who developed the torture program, and his program at the University of Pennsylvania has gotten more than $30 million in federal funds. So that's how God's blessings flow, huh? We Christianized the military. God apparently, their God, the God that Seligman believes in, supports torture, and then they get essentially cash benefits in the form of this sole source federal grant, and the language here is chilling when they basically say, well, there's no other program like it, and so this is the only entity that qualifies for this funding of taxpayer dollars.
Yes, that's thank you for capturing that, Peter, because you did an excellent job, and that's exactly it. And by the way, it's certainly a question, that I have as to, to additional questions as to, why just his group, beyond what the government says. And, I noted in my story that he is an advisor or sits on the Defense Department's advisory board, which basically provides advice to the Secretary of Defense. Certainly seems like a conflict of interest, that type of cronyism that we're all well aware of. And again, just raises further questions as to, why he received this. In addition, Peter, I also want to say that I've spoken to the Army since my story has been published, particularly in the, to ask them about informed consent and whether there was a waiver or whether this program was presented to what's known as an institutional review board. As I indicated, this is more or less an experiment, okay? And, the previous programs that they've had in place for PTSD any other mental health issue has been within the Defense Department, within the Army's medical structure. This has been removed from that area and placed into education. So even though with education, however, if you're conducting any sort of experiment, if you're conducting any sort of research, even if it is educational research, you still need to you know, present it to an institutional review board. They should, you know, either provide an approval or not. You know, you're saying that you want to conduct this type of research, and soldiers or any subjects should you know, are required to give their informed consent. Now, the Army does have a waiver of informed consent. You know, if it's to advance sort of a, you know, a medical product, or it's for the benefit of the soldier. But that's a it's a very important question, because the Army told me last week, Lieutenant Colonel David Patterson said, this is not a research program. Well, Dr. Martin Seligman, I quote in my story, who says this is one of the largest experiments in the history of psychology.
Yeah.
Let
me read the quote. This is the largest study, 1.1 million soldiers, psychology has ever been involved in, and it will yield definitive data about whether or not it works. Well, that just affirms
that
what you said. It is a trial, a test, and it is, unfortunately, what it brings to mind is the reporting that you've done on the medical and other tests that we conducted on humans related to waterboarding and other torture techniques. And so what is the difference between testing brainwashing techniques of a religious nature on members of our armed forces and testing torture techniques on people who we captured?
Exactly. It's a really good question. I certainly would be interested to see what the Army has to say about it. But, you know, it all comes down to, you know, the cliche, rose is a rose. I mean, this is an experiment. This is exactly what it is. And, you know, for the Army to say to me, literally in an email, saying this is not a research program, so we did not need to obtain a waiver of informed consent on the one hand, and we did not need to go before an institutional review board. So they're telling me that they did not need to go before an institutional review board or obtain a waiver because this is not a research program. Well, I beg to differ, because the person who is has received $31 million to assist them on this program, his resume, he notes that he is an advisor to the program, looks at this as his personal experiment, and the 1.1 million soldiers are his personal guinea pigs. So that certainly should, people should be very concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the, you know, the no-bid contract raises questions in and of itself. But I think when, you know, the follow-ups come out, Peter, we're going to see that there has been quite a bit of errors, to put it mildly, by mm-hmm. By the Army, because I think that they certainly need to do that. And I should also say that Martin Seligman would have needed to go to an institutional review board on his own at the University of Pennsylvania. And I called them. They have yet to call me back to, you know, I've emailed them. They have yet to respond to my queries about whether or not he has obtained approval from an institutional review board.
And Jason, you quote two powerful critics in your article. The first is Bryant Welch, who was he's a former executive director for professional practice at the American Psychological Association. He said, personally, I have not been able to find a meaningful distinction between positive psychology, this program, and Norman Vincent Peale's Power of Positive Thinking. Both emphasize substituting positive thoughts for unhappy or negative thoughts. And I would just say that what they're promoting here is a kind of denial.
Right.
That you know, you can engage your spiritual side, and you can promote positive thinking and positive feelings against reality. The reality,
yeah.
Particularly if you're deployed in a combat zone.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, some of the other critics, by the way, are, you know, that I've quoted is, you know, Chris Hedges. You know, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, an author, and
a former I wouldn't call him a seminarian, but he was a theology. I think he has a PhD in theology.
Yes, from Harvard. Harvard Divinity
right.
School, if I'm mm-hmm. not mistaken.
Yeah.
And he, you know, made a very important note that, you know, this is, you know, this type of positive psychology, this positive thinking is so prevalent. It's rampant within corporations.
Well, let me pull two quotes here from Hedges. He says that positive psychology, which claims to be able to engineer happiness and provides the psychological tools for enforcing corporate conformity, is to the corporate state what eugenics was to the Nazis. And he continues, positive psychology is a quack science that throws a smokescreen over corporate domination, abuse, and greed. Those who fail to exhibit positive attitudes, no matter the external reality, are seen as maladjusted and in need of assistance. Their attitudes need correction. Now, how different is this from the Soviet-era re-education camps, where if you were not sufficiently communist, they sent you away and tortured you and tried to brainwash you until you submitted, and some people never recovered or returned
right.
from that, but those who did return clearly had been taught a lesson in how to toe the commie line.
Right, right. It's something that, first of all, let me just say that I think Hedges captured in it, and writing this story and reporting on it was an education for me, because admittedly, I was unaware of the, positive psychology movement, and even understood that it was a movement, prior to reporting the story. So I've seen both sides. I've weighed both sides, and I can certainly understand that that people believe that this there's benefits to this. However, when we're talking about our taxpayer dollars, we're getting into an entirely different area.
And also the coercive atmosphere of being a soldier in the military,
right? Yeah,
where you're told to respond to orders. And you get an order to take this computer quiz that then brands you as insufficiently spiritual. Well, in a military context, what do you do about that? I guess you seek further orders on how to fix your spiritual deficiencies.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's that's the problem, Peter. Is that they're turning the. They're not providing the soldiers with the true care that they need, and instead of doing that, they're making cosmetic changes. It's another way of just saying numb yourself. I think it's really problematic, and as I indicated, I think that it's far bigger than just the spiritual component
mm-hmm.
Aspect of it. I mean, that certainly is troubling. I think that there is something to be said for having a strong emotional, psychological, and family foundation if you are a U.S. soldier on your third deployment, right?
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. I'm not an expert, but I'm not sure taking a test from a computer is the way to accomplish that on a computer. I think that is just a poor way to address an epidemic.
Mm-hmm. And Jason, I applaud you for this story. You did a lot of digging here, and I think you broke some important news and some important ground. I didn't see it, but I do know that Keith Olbermann covered your reporting and interviewed Mikey Weinstein. And I also know there was a story on NPR that appeared to be based on your reporting, although they left out the whole part about Dr. Seligman and
yeah.
The University of Pennsylvania. Did they borrow these stories without proper credit to Mr. Leopold?
It's sort of, as I have explained to a few people, I've become very used to it. And yes, they did, as a matter of fact. I think that, I'm not shy to say that, I reported this story and it received quite a bit of attention. It's a result of, my reporting that attracted the other news organizations. While I'm happy about it, and it's great to see you know, these stories get out there to a much larger audience. You know, some out there have not, been have not shared credit for whatever reason. But I am very grateful that Keith Olbermann did, and in fact, USA Today did as well last week. So,
and in those two cases, just to be clear, they did give you attribution.
They did indeed. Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes,
good.
They did, and I'm I'm very grateful for that. And you know, part of this, Peter, as you know, is that I operate. You know, I work for an independent news organization. We're a nonprofit. We don't have tens of millions of dollars or the types of or type of resources that some of these major media organizations have. So it takes a lot of work, to put a story like this together. I'm one person, working on a shoestring, to be able to or to report this. So, the goal is to, is to hopefully get people to recognize it. But when they do recognize it, I don't think it's I think it's okay to ask that we receive that type of credit.
Yeah.
I've been dealing with this for the past year. For certainly my story's on BP, many on BP, and a number of others as well.
Yeah. Well, Jason, great work, and I want you to hang on because I want to get a quick update from you on Tom DeLay's conviction and sentencing in Texas. But first, a little musical interlude, the gospel according to Country Joe.
I used to expose myself to people out on the streets. But now when I feel the urge to sin, I just fall down on my knees and I sing,
Holy Roller, roll one time for me. Holy Roller, roll one time for me. Holy
Texas was the scene of the crime. Tom DeLay is the convicted criminal. Redistricting was his goal. And he was convicted on virtually all charges of money laundering as he converted money that was sent to Washington for federal races to contributions to political campaigns in Texas for state legislators who then did Tom DeLay's bidding. And in the middle of a decade, they redrew the congressional districts. And in the following election, the Republican Party picked up five, if not six, seats in Texas. A grand political stroke on Tom DeLay's part, but it finally caught up with him, Jason. And I believe Ronnie Earle was the original prosecutor in Austin who brought the case. Tell us, the facts here, and then we'll talk about DeLay's attempt to spin this as a liberal conspiracy.
Sure. Well, this case dates back to September 2002, when Texans for a Republican majority, that's Tom DeLay's or was Tom DeLay's political action committee, the group turned over a check for $190,000 to the Republican National Committee, and those funds that that the Political Action Committee received, they came from corporate lobbyists. And witnesses in DeLay's trial said that these were corporate lobbyists who were trying to influence the outcome of the election in elections in Texas involving Republican candidates in certain districts. And you know, Texas has a law that, basically says that, you cannot accept any campaign donations from corporations, more or less. And, once these candidates were elected, they then went and pushed through this redistricting plan that DeLay sponsored, redrawing the Texas district map for D.C., that basically favored Republicans,
right?
And the prosecution said this was the centerpiece, this was the focus of you know, his whole plan. This was a clear-cut case of money laundering. And
it added a new term to the lexicon, redistricting.
Redistricting, yes. Yes. I mean, you know, I have to say, it's pretty... I'm surprised simply because, you know, we haven't seen... You know, we've seen Abramoff and Duke Cunningham. You know, they were convicted. But let's face it, Peter, Tom DeLay is an incredibly powerful person. It was a powerful majority leader, a lot of connections, very powerful in Texas. And the fact that he was not only convicted but sentenced to 3 years in prison is certainly astonishing given, you know, his power and influence. You know, so he showed no remorse at his sentencing. And, you know, that's actually, I think that was a really, you know, bad move on DeLay's part, because I believe that played into the, you know, judge's decision. I mean, he had no remorse. He said, well, I don't think I did anything wrong. Well, you know, the jury disagrees, and the prosecution presented a very strong case. And, you know, this case, it was very close to being shut down and derailed. You know, the fact that it got off the ground late last year to the point where, you know, after 3 weeks he was convicted is pretty amazing. You know, prosecutors called more than 30 witnesses, you know, that all testified, for the most part, that DeLay sidestepped the Texas law that, as I noted, you know, prohibits corporate donations being made to political campaigns, directly or indirectly, meaning that, you know, you can't just give it to Tom DeLay, who's then going to, you know, use it and turn around and give it to the Republican National Committee.
But Jason, you're not being fair to my good friend, the former pest control expert, Tom DeLay,
because
you know, this happened in the liberal bastion of Austin, Texas. It's the Berkeley of the Lone Star State. And I love his claim that this is criminalizing politics.
Yeah. I have to say that, you know, it's funny. I was glad that you sort of picked up on that one. That was criminalizing politics, you know.
Hey, there's a bump.
Oxymoron? I'm not sure what.
Well,
it is,
I think there's a bumper sticker in there. You know, when you criminalize politics, then only criminals will be politicians.
Right. Yeah. It's you know, so it's certainly one that I think we'll be using for years and years and years. But you know, DeLay said that you know, at his sentencing or outside after his sentencing, I still maintain I'm innocent. You know, the criminalization of politics undermines our system. You know, his attorney was so upset by this, you know, stormed out of the courtroom, said that this will never stand. You know, they're challenging this, and the prosecution was, you know, prosecutor Steve Brand, who was at the sentencing. I mean, he was urging the judge to immediately, you know, order DeLay to begin his prison sentence because of the fact he wasn't showing any remorse and he doesn't believe he's, you know, he's done anything wrong.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, Peter, I actually truly believe, based on the law here, that this is going to stand, that DeLay will serve prison time.
Well, I hope that's true. It's important to hold people accountable, even if our president insists on looking forward and not backward.
And by the way, that's important that you brought that up because, you know, the Justice Department basically dropped this.
Yeah.
You know, as you know, and just let it go, which is pretty much what they've done with anything that has amounted to, you know, an investigation from involved former, current or former lawmakers, the late Ted Stevens, you know, being one, but they just haven't bothered to pick it back up, and it does certainly fit that you know, look forward, not backward mantra.
And this raises a question that I realize is now moot, because The calendar has caught up with us, and there will be official redistricting for the next decade in Texas occurring over the next calendar year. The extent to which it's gerrymandered to fit Tom DeLay's vision remains to be seen. But the question I raise is that if DeLay has been convicted, then the fruits of his crime were 5 or 6 congressional seats. And had this prosecution occurred on a timely basis, we might even have seen some of those seats being subjected to election reruns, or they might have been redrawn to be a less politicized gerrymandered map. And so that's something we'll never know the legal outcome of. But there is one other factor, and that is during the time that Tom DeLay was defending himself from these charges, he made repeated appearances on corporate media. Chris Matthews is very fond of him. And I never saw any reference to the indictments. They
right.
brought him on as the former majority leader, the
That's
hammer,
right.
retired congressman, yada, yada. But nobody ever said, well, and by the way, he is facing charges in Texas. They treated it like a parking ticket.
Right. They certainly did. And, you know, perhaps the his appearance on Dancing with the Stars sort of, helped that. He was, a celebrity by Hollywood standards, I guess, for a short period of time. But no, they did not refer to him that as the alleged money launderer,
mm-hmm.
Conspirator.
Right.
And let's face it, that's not really a surprise.
Well, and Jason, I embarrassed you once with this already, so I'll tell you again. I will always connect Tom DeLay, capital D-E, capital L-A-Y, with the little tube that I found in my dad's dresser drawer to address premature ejaculation.
I think that's hilarious, Peter. I have that will forever be seared into my unconsciousness whenever I hear DeLay.
All right, Jason, thanks for your great work on both of these issues, and we will talk again very soon.
Look forward to it. Thanks so much, Peter.
Jason Leopold, Deputy Managing Editor, truthout.org. We give him credit for the work that he does. Thanks for listening to this episode. Send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. I dare you.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until